Thank you very much. Especially for turning out on this nice day. I've never been in Ann Arbor before. I'm 51. That's 51 years that I have not spent in Ann Arbor. And I had no idea how beautiful it is. And I'm assuming that the weather is like is always like it is today. But maybe not. So it's a real pleasure to be here for the first time. I took a stroll this morning and saw the famous Michigan Stadium and wandered around that area. I had a delicious breakfast on a friend's recommendation at Sava. Is that right, Elizabeth? At Sava. So I go into the restaurant, and the hostess looked at me a little oddly and then took me to a table. And then a few minutes later, came up to me a little nervously. And, you know, I'm not accustomed to being recognized for being the editor of the Modern Love column. In fact, it's never happened once in my life. And I thought, is this about to happen in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that I'm going to be recognized? Maybe she saw me on a flyer or something, and or maybe as a fan of the column and saw me on TV. Is this really about to happen? So she comes toward me and she says, "Sorry, but have you seen Breaking Bad?" And I said, "Yes, I've seen Breaking Bad." And she said, "You look exactly like Walter White, and you look so much like Walter White that when you first came in, I thought, is this really, you know, him?" And I was all nervous about. So my wife has said that I look like Walter White, and she considers that sort of a sexy thing for some reason. But anyway, so she was starstruck for all the wrong reasons. And I didn't tell her the reason that I was actually in town because, you know, she wouldn't have known what I was talking about. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about this column and how it came to be and how it works and how it led to this book that I've written and have been touring around talking about, and to give you a taste of that. And then I'd be happy to take whatever questions you have for as long as you have them, and then happy to meet you and sign books afterward. So the Modern Love column, I have a history in my life of backing into things rather than aggressively going after things, and that's what happened with this column, too. First, I'm not going to assume that everyone knows what it is, or at least the specifics of it. The Modern Love column appears in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times every week. It comes out online on the website on Thursday evenings, typically. It is a true personal story about someone's relationship life. It doesn't have to be a romantic story about romantic love. It can be about parenthood. It can be about friendship. Most of the stories are about romantic love, but I interpret love broadly. And so the column is as broad as the words modern love can imply. It started in October of 2004, and the essays are about a little over 1,500 words, which is about 5 double-spaced pages. These are often the most important stories in the person's life, told in that amount of space, and not summarized, but told with dialogue and details and really brought to life. It was several years into the column before I realized that the majority of essays I was publishing were the most important story in that person's life. And I think that's what readers who follow the column appreciate about it, that people are talking honestly about what relationships are rather than the fantasy of what a relationship should be, which can often be damaging to a relationship's durability. we like to fantasize about romantic love in this country and in other countries. And I think it's helpful to hear personal stories about the push and pull and the rough and tumble of what real relationships are over the long haul. Because relationships didn't used to have such a long haul in the past. It wasn't all that long ago that the average lifespan was in our 40s. You didn't have to put up with someone for that long. And now we're really expecting to find someone, whether you believe in monogamy or not, or in the divorce is a good thing or not. Most of us expect to find one person and stay with that person until we die. And that can be a long time. It can be a long time with a lot of challenges. So that's what the column is about. And how it began, I had aspirations of being a writer throughout my 20s and into my 30s, and those aspirations were crushed by cruel people like me who didn't choose to publish me. I wrote and wrote and wrote short stories and published them in journals, but this was no way to make a living, and so I gave up. And I got married, and I took a series of office jobs, and my wife was a writer as well, except she was actually a successful writer who wrote a novel and got an agent and sold her book while I was toiling away at these daytime 9-to-5 jobs in New York and feeling resentful and bitter. So we got married. A few years after we got married, we had one child. A few years after that, my wife was pregnant again with our second child, who was going to be a boy. And our expenses were spiraling out of control. I really felt like my life was sort of a pressure cooker. And that's when I decided that I would take up writing again. Because I thought when my son was born and we had two little rugrats crawling around the house making messes, that I really wouldn't have any time and that would be the end of it. So I started working on a novel and said I'll finish it in 7 months before he's born. And I just about did it. I worked from 9 until 1 in the morning at night, and then those pages, whatever I was able to get out during that stretch, I would then work on during my lunch break the next day. I'd print them out and edit them over my lunch break, and then I'd go back at it at night again. And I almost wrote a novel that way. He was born, the first 3 months were utter chaos. And after that, I went back to it and was able to finish in a few months after that. I got an agent for the book over a long weekend, and she sold the novel about 4 weeks later. And that utterly changed my life, not in a monetary sense, but it allowed me to sort of return to the writing world and feel like I was a writer. That novel was called After Lucy, and it was published in April of 2000. We couldn't afford New York City anymore, and we moved to Northampton, Massachusetts. And life with two little kids, with two working parents, it can be hard. And these days, it's especially hard on women, because the expectations on women of being able to work and have a harmonious marriage and be a perfect mother are expectations that can really fuel a lot of disappointment and frustration, because it's hard to do all those things at once and do them all well. So my wife was feeling frustrated at these challenges, and a lot of her friends were too. And so she decided that she would do a book that collected essays about these frustrations. And a friend suggested she title this book The Bitch in the House. She worried about titling it that and whether, you know, Target would stock it and Barnes & Noble and places like that. But she went with it. And there weren't great expectations for the book, because essay anthologies don't typically sell well. And this essay anthology became a bestseller. And she was on the Today Show with Katie Couric and on NPR. And suddenly it was like the number 4 bestseller on Amazon. And it became this huge popular book. I did not intend to collect essays by men talking about their view of marriage, but based on the success of her book, I did the male response. When my wife's book came out, Jay Leno did two monologue jokes about the title of her book. I don't remember what the first one was. But the second one, he said, so this book I was talking about, The Bitch in the House, it turns out that that was a follow-up to the number one bestseller, That Bastard on the Couch. So I thought, well, if Jay Leno gives you a title, you should probably take it. So I called my book The Bastard on the Couch, and it was men's essays about, and these were powerful, you know, reflective essays about struggling in relationships and wanting to be a good partner and wanting to be a good husband and wanting to be a good father, and struggling with it. So these two books together, especially edited by husband and wife, were easy attention getters and got a lot of coverage. And one person who sat up and took notice was a man named Tripp Gabriel, who's the style editor of the New York Times, and he's the founding editor of that section. And he did a story on us, and then he called us in and said, or called us up and said, "I have an idea. I think the kinds of essays you have in your books would be good to have in Styles on a weekly basis. I think people would that would really develop a fan base, and people would really like that." The Times had run essays like that years before. They had a column called Hers and About Men, and those had faded away. They'd move different sections and then faded away and eventually became what's now the Lives page in the back of the New York Times Magazine, which is really a different form. It's much shorter and much broader. And he wanted to bring back this storytelling about relationships on a weekly basis. And he thought we should do that as a couple, my wife and I. We didn't think as a married couple that was such a good thing for our marriage to do that job together. And luckily, we started it together. We couldn't say no. We started the job together. This was back in the summer of 2004. And then my wife was working on a second novel. She didn't really like the job that much, and I really did. So she handed off the reins to me before the column even launched in October and said, "You do it." And I did. My only concern was how long it would last, because this was going to be my job, and I was a little concerned with two little kids and about job security. And I said to Tripp, Gabriel at the time, "Well, how long do these sorts of columns usually last?" And he said, "I don't know, 1 year, 3 years." And that was good enough for me for a while. And the column has now lasted coming up on 10 years. And there are two choices that I made at the beginning, unaware of, that I think led to the longevity of the column and the popularity of the column, which has increased in readership every single year. And the Times has various metrics by which they measure the popularity of things. One of the things they keep track of is the most searched term on the New York Times website. And the most searched term on the New York Times website for the past 6 years has been modern love. I'm not quite sure what to make of this, because you'd think people after 6 years would have found it. But apparently not, or apparently there's so many new people trying to find it that they continue to search for it. But the number one search term is modern love, and typically the second most search term is China. So people care more about finding modern love than they do China. And then it sort of goes down from whatever the other top news stories are of the day or of the week. But it's become incredibly popular, and I can't say that I would have predicted this in any way. And people are trying to always make more of it. They think this ought to be able to turn into something else. So there was a full-length musical made of modern love that was based on modern love essays, and it was called Love is Love, and it focused on, I think, four or five essays And it was created by Martin Charnin, who's the person who created Annie, the musical Annie. So it had some oomph behind it. It didn't work. It opened in Miami. People didn't like it, and nothing became of it. Then someone wanted to make a TV show of Modern Love, and they decided they would base it on the life of the Modern Love editor and his failing marriage, and they would have a weekly, they would use an actual essay each week as the B story. And this was created by people who had created 6 Feet Under, the HBO show 6 Feet Under. So it was a similar setup where it's a regular family and then a new story each week. And it was the same length, and it started off being done for HBO, but then HBO didn't take it up, and then Lifetime picked it up, and they actually shot a pilot episode. I don't know how many millions of dollars it cost them. Eric Stoltz was me, the actor Eric Stoltz. Ali Sheedy was my boss, and Cara Buono was my colleague, and Robert Klein was my father. And there were a whole bunch of other marvelous, marvelous cast members. And they shot a whole episode. I thought it was great. I couldn't wait for it to turn into a series. Instead, they picked up a show called Life's a Trip, which was a reality show about Sarah Palin's grandchild that they then canceled within weeks. But I knew what they were about because it's a very expensive show to produce, and they canceled every show, every scripted drama that they'd paid to have pilot episodes done for. Then finally, a guy created a CD, wrote to me, said, I want to create a music album. A man named David Lockwood said, I want to create a music album based all on Modern Love essays. And I said, well, I've heard that sort of thing before, but, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. And 2 years later, I got this in the mail, which is a full, beautiful CD of music called Modern Love by David Lockwood. I think there are 14 songs, 13 songs, and I think 10 of them are directly inspired by Modern Love essays. So he sent me a bunch of these, and I'd like to give this to somebody. Today I've been giving this out on tour. So I'll give it to the most loving person in the audience. And that person is going to be wearing pink somewhere on their body. All right. I guess that qualifies. That qualifies. That's true. I have no other metric. Would you like it? It goes to you. You're the closest. It was funny. I spoke in this big auditorium in Washington, D.C. There were 570 people there. And I did this, gave away a CD, and I was going to give it to the person who was wearing pink. And there were two people very close to each other, the person closest to me wearing pink, and there were two people very close to me who were both wearing pink, but one was much more pink than the other, which was more orange. And I gestured to the one who was wearing the pink shirt, and the one who was wearing the orange shirt thought I was gesturing to her, and she got up and started toward me, and she got it just out of sheer aggression. It would have been too awkward to, like, you know, yank it back from her. Anyway. So I started this book after editing this column for 8 years. And when you have a job like this that's deadline-driven and is a lot of daily work of just meeting your deadlines, it's hard to sort of see the big picture. And I thought, I'm in a unique position here. I felt like I was in the Times Square of relationships with relationships whizzing by me at light speed and sampling from this and sampling from that. There are times when I read hundreds of essays, well, not hundreds, over 100 essays a day. And each of these are real, often very poignant stories about what someone is dealing with, whether it's cancer or birth difficulties or divorce or whatever, or finding someone or figuring out what love is and whether you have it or not. And I wanted to make sense of it. and what can be learned about how things are changing at sort of light speed with technology and how we meet people and how we figure out who we're compatible with. And I wanted to find out what could be made of this and this huge volume, which I estimated at some 50,000 stories that have crossed my desk in the past 10 years. At that point, 8 years into it, it was 40,000 some stories. So I started to cast about in stories that I'd published and what I learned from them, because I feel like I learned so much from these stories, even though they're not preaching. They're just telling. This is who I am. This is what I'm dealing with. But we've always learned from stories. We learn more from stories than from advice. We teach ourselves through stories, and we have since the beginning of time. And I feel like that's what these stories do. They teach us how people are living and how they're dealing with things, and they become touchstones for how we might behave in those situations. So I started sifting through these stories and trying to figure out what I could bring to this, because the subject of love is something that's been written about before. So what was I going to add to this that someone else couldn't? And the result of that is this book, Love Illuminated, which takes us through the arc of romantic love, from meeting people to being with them for 50 or 60 years. And I tried to do it in a funny way as possible, because if you don't have a sense of humor about it, you're at a disadvantage. In fact, one thing that holds couples together more than anything else is having a shared sense of humor. I mean, it just, I see that again and again. You can get through a lot. So what I'd like to do, just to give you a taste of this book, is read just one page from the introduction, and then just read the beginning of chapter 2. And then I'm happy to take your questions about book, about column. I'm not so good at giving relationship advice. I was prepping for the most nervous-making thing I did with this tour, which is like being on the Katie Couric Show for like 25 minutes on live television, which is not something I think I handle well. And the producer at the beginning said, we'd like to have someone at the audience, would you be comfortable if someone from the audience asked you maybe what you should wear before going out on a certain date? And I was trying to be accommodating, but I was like, no way. You know, that is not at all what I do. So she said, well, thanks for being honest about that. So here's just a short stretch from the introduction. At the New York Times, I edit a personal essay column called Modern Love, in which strangers spill their guts about their relationship woes. It's a job I have worked at more or less full time for the past 9 years, a period during which some 50,000 laments about love have filtered through my brain and often my heart. The stories arrive by email around the clock, pouring into my laptop, dribbling out of my printer, and spilling across the tables of my office and home. They follow me into bed at night, tag along on family vacations, and ping into my iPhone when I'm walking my dogs or standing on the sidelines of my son's soccer games. They also frequently are told to me in person, at cocktail parties, at public events, and in planes, trains, and automobiles. When people find out what I do, they invariably say, "You must know a lot about love." Or they might invoke the name of the newspaper sex columnist played by Sarah Jessica Parker on Sex and the City, and remark, "You're like a male Carrie Bradshaw." The first person to make that observation was a journalist who interviewed me early on in my job when I was so out of the loop love-wise that I didn't even know who Carrie Bradshaw was. I thought the journalist had said, Terry Bradshaw, the famous Steelers quarterback, now Fox Sports analyst. I'd grown up idolizing during my suburban Pittsburgh childhood. It didn't occur to me to ask what Terry Bradshaw had to do with editing confessional essays about relationships. All I could think was, I'm like a male Terry Bradshaw? But he is male. Shows how little I knew about love back then. Now, 9 years later, I apparently know enough about love to fill a book. So I organized these chapters around questions. Because these stories aren't asking questions directly, but they're all asking questions implicitly because they're things people can't figure out. And a big question today, the book begins with, is it better to work really hard at finding someone and finding love because there's so many ways to do that, or is it better to be relaxed about it and leave it to fate? This is a really important technical question for people. How much work are they going to put into it, and are they going to ruin it if they put too much work into it? That's what the first chapter is about. The second chapter, then, is about destiny, which is sort of an old-fashioned word that's become incredibly meaningful. When you think science and math and algorithms are going to point us to who we should be compatible with, people will participate in that, but on some basic level don't trust it. And because these days people are dating so many strangers with online dating, this just didn't used to happen. You used to always, unless you ran into some totally random person who was new in town, you didn't used to go out with someone that not only you didn't know, but no one who you knew either. And now, often people will date nothing but strangers, often stacking them up back to back each night or during a day on a Saturday. And this has a lot of curious side effects, including people feeling basically distrustful about whoever they're about to meet, but also feeling like there was no reason for them to come together. And people want a reason. They want something like some sign from the heavens that this was the person for them. So over and over I hear these stories where people are grasping for signs of fate to seal the relationship that happened in more of a mechanical way through some sort of list or through some sort of choice online. And story after story where people are struggling for that sense of, like, this is who I should be with, and is this love? Is this really what it is? People are always asking them, it seems like it's obvious, but people are always asking themselves, is this it? You know, it's kind of a hard thing to define at times. So this chapter is called Destiny, Meant to Be or Not Meant to Be. Liz was dating a guy named Bob. The thing about Bob, though, was he had made a conscious decision not to own a car and instead to use only his bicycle for transportation. This was in Los Angeles. Living without a car might have been a healthy choice for Bob and for the environment, but it presented an obstacle for dating, especially in car-centric LA. Because Bob couldn't exactly pick up a date on his bicycle and take her anywhere. He either had to meet her within biking distance or rely on her to pick him up and take him places. Liz liked Bob, but as she tried to figure out if they had a romantic future, she wondered if his intentionally car-free lifestyle was a bad sign. One evening, Liz picked up Bob in her battered Volkswagen, and they headed off to a comedy club on Sunset Boulevard. She had wanted to go to a movie, but he'd really pushed for the comedy club. Bob's lobbying for the comedy club, while being unable to drive them there, struck Liz as being yet another sign that perhaps this relationship wasn't meant to be. Upon arrival at the club, they joined the line snaking down the sidewalk toward the entrance. As they waited, they heard the roar of an accelerating car engine coming from behind them. They spun around just in time to see a large 1970s-era car jump the curb and head straight for them. Liz bolted for the wall of the building, scrambling for safety amid a crush of other clubgoers as she felt the car zoom by just inches away. In the confusion that followed, she looked around for Bob. Where was he? And who was that man in the middle of Sunset Boulevard, wearing a blue shirt and no pants? Hadn't Bob been wearing a blue shirt? Was the man in the street Bob? He was. Liz rushed over to find him, lucid and ambulatory, but badly injured. Help arrived, and off went Bob in an ambulance. Later, in the hospital emergency room, Bob told Liz how he'd been hit by the car, carried on the hood, snagged by his pants, dragged into the street, and deposited there, bottomless. Luckily, though, he had been able to push her out of the car's path just before he was hit. He did? That's not how Liz remembered it. She remembered scrambling out of the car's path on her own. Though it was hard to know for sure, everything had happened so fast. Sure, it was possible Bob had pushed her out of the way. Yet Liz worried that if he had, it would be a sign she should keep dating him. Because if you're already dating someone, and he saves your life by risking his own, shouldn't your bond grow even stronger, all other factors being equal? But Liz didn't want their bond to grow stronger. In her ever-evolving calculus of whether or not they were meant to be, most signs were lining up on the negative side. This sign, though, would be a huge positive that might threaten to swamp the negatives. A reasonable reaction to Liz's story would be to say that if that's how she was thinking about the relationship, she and Bob obviously weren't meant for each other. If you're in love, you're not grasping at signs and weighing pros and cons to decide your romantic future as if love is some algebraic equation to solve. If you're in love, you're not constantly mulling transportation and entertainment preferences as indicators of compatibility. And you're certainly not thinking that a boyfriend saving your life might actually be a bad thing. If you're in love, you know it. To which I would say, yes, some people know when they're in love, but others don't. They feel a bond with the person, but they're not sure if that bond reaches the exalted level of love. They have a connection and shared interests. They feel attraction and longing, but also a lot of doubt and fear. And they worry that what they feel might not be enough to sustain a lifetime commitment or anywhere near that long. We talk about falling in love as if all the process involves is finding the right person, stepping off the ledge, and letting gravity do its thing. But for many, love is more about finding a right-ish person and then trying to figure out if what the two of you have together is enough. There seem to be, in short, two kinds of love, the kind you can't deny and the kind you eventually come around to. In terms of relationship durability, neither kind seems any more promising than the other. The swooning couple who can't keep their hands off each other might crash and burn in year 2 or 5 of marriage, while the deliberative couple that belabored their decision for years might stay together happily forever. It's just that those in the first group feel confident about their love going in, and those in the second group don't. So they need to weigh pros and cons and talk about it a lot and seek the guidance of others. How did you know it was love? They'll ask their partnered up friends. We just knew, their friends will reply maddeningly. For couples wrestling with this dilemma, signs and a belief in destiny can play a surprisingly influential role in how the couple thinks about their romantic future. Sometimes these signs are actual behaviors or choices, as they were with Liz and Bob. Other times, they're magical coincidences that make a relationship seem destined. Take the case of Patrick and Jeff, who met during a night of organized speed dating at a New York gay and lesbian center. They liked each other right away. Maybe Patrick thought they were even meant for each other. But he was troubled by the unromantic reality of their How We Met story, which involved locking eyes while sitting on metal folding chairs with numbers pinned to their chests. He had always expected to find his one true love through some magical coincidence, like picking up a dropped glove at the Metropolitan Museum and handing it to a stranger who would then steal his heart. Patrick had other reasons to be wary. He was West Coast mellow, while Jeff was East Coast driven. Jeff was Jewish, and Patrick had a long, checkered history of falling for Jewish men only to get his heart broken. Finally, Jeff had confessed he was a runner, the kind of person who flees relationships when they get hard. And I said this out of order. Finally, Jeff confessed that he was a runner, the kind of person who flees relationships when they get hard, while Patrick admitted that he was a willer, the kind of person who tries to will a relationship to work out in a way that sometimes overwhelms the object of his affection. Could a runner and a willer succeed? They were getting along great, but Patrick was hesitant about getting his hopes up. He wanted a sign from above that they were meant for each other, something that would wipe away the ordinariness and intentionality of their speed dating origins. Then one evening at dinner, Jeff mentioned that he and his family used to go to Chicago to visit his mother's best friend, a woman named Monica Morris. Monica Morris? Patrick's mother had had a best friend named Monica Morris. In fact, his mother used to talk about Monica all the time. She was one of the most influential and memorable friends she'd ever had. Patrick remembered photos of his mother and Monica skiing together at Lake Tahoe. Monica was a bridesmaid at his mother's wedding. Could it be the same Monica Morris? Nah. First, Monica Morris isn't such an unusual name, and there surely were plenty wandering about. Second, Jeff's mother was a Jew who was born in China, moved to Japan, then Israel, and finally New York, while Patrick's mother, who had died 7 years before Patrick and Jeff met, was a Scottish Presbyterian who'd come from Glasgow and lived the rest of her life in San Francisco. There was zero overlap. Then Jeff invited Patrick to meet his mother at her home on Long Island for Rosh Hashanah. And while they were there, at lunch that day, Jeff's mother, as if on cue, started telling Monica Morris stories. When Patrick mentioned the coincidence of his mother's best friend also being named Monica Morris, Jeff's mother was surprised but dismissed any notion that it might be the same person. A little later, though, she began talking about how she'd once visited Monica in San Francisco when Monica was based there as a flight attendant. "Ma," Jeff blurted, "that's the link. Patrick's Monica Morris is from San Francisco. We're calling her." When Jeff's mother called, Patrick got on the phone, introduced himself, mentioned his mother's name, and then asked if Monica knew her. "Yes," Monica replied. "She was my best friend in high school." Patrick wept on the phone as Monica told him stories about his mother that he'd never heard before, stories that briefly brought her back to life for him. This, Patrick thought, was his dropped glove at the Met. This was their connection, their sign. Maybe despite their red flags and their dull "how we met" story, they were destined to find each other after all, and destined to stay together too. They weren't. As the willer and runner they each were, Patrick soon started willing the relationship to be, and then Jeff started running, and that was the end of them. But ever the romantic, Patrick still believed that he and Jeff were brought together for a reason, and that reason was to grant him emotional access to his long-deceased mother through Monica Morris's stories of their childhood friendship, a gift for which he will be forever grateful. Thanks a lot. So I would be happy to answer any questions about my book project or the column or the New York Times.
And again, if you have a question, just raise your hand. I'll come right around.
I only can't really speak to the later. We had a change in leadership at the New York Times that was a little surprising a few days ago. I know nothing.
How do you choose the essay of the week if you read 100 a day?
How do I choose the essay every week? I don't get 100 a day. I get about 125 or so a week. And so the odds of getting published are 1 in 125. And to me, it's usually pretty obvious. And people assume that a lot of bad writing is being submitted, just that the volume is big and there's a lot of bad writing. And that's not true. Almost everyone who submits to the column, I would say, reads the column regularly, religiously, knows what it's about, knows how to write. And it's really sorting out a kind of story that that seems too familiar often. The situation is too familiar. The person hasn't made more of the story than just telling it. When people tell stories about their lives rather than telling a made-up fictional story, they often resort to summarizing it and not making use of dialogue and specific detail because they think, well, I don't remember exactly what my words were, and so it becomes summarized, and that's a mistake. You need to bring the reader into the story and bring it alive and make the reader feel like they're in that room and hearing those conversations. And a mistake people often make is I'll run a column about something, a certain topic, say a daughter struggling with a parent who's suffering from Alzheimer's and what the impact of that is. And then over the next couple of months, I'll get all kinds of stories about that. And that's always a bad impulse. Like, I'm always moving away from what's just been published toward something that feels fresh. I'm always looking, the ratio of the what's published in the column in terms of men and women is about 80% women to 20% men, and that's exactly reflective of what comes in. So I'm always looking to increase the numbers of men being published and to have their perspective. But usually it's, and the words modern love matter, and the section that the column is in matters, which is about trends and style and things happening now. And a disqualifying aspect for so many of the submissions I get is there's nothing contemporary about it, even setting. It doesn't have to comment on love in a new way, but if it's happened within recent years, then at least it's happening now. I get a lot of stories about things that happened 30 years ago, and it doesn't have any strong foothold or handhold in the present. And that's just can't, it doesn't fit in any way in the section or underneath the heading Modern Love. So an awful lot gets disqualified for that reason.
Okay, I'm going to go right here.
I would think if you get 125 stories a week that some weeks you would get two or three that you feel should be published, and perhaps you publish one of them the next week.
I can build up an inventory in that way if I have enough quality material. What I find instead is that I just get more discriminating. And something that may have turned my head if I had less to work with doesn't turn my head anymore. And I always feel like it's a little bit of the online dating syndrome, I have to say, where the more people you have, the more chance you think that someone really perfect is out there. And the more submissions I have, and right now I'm very backed up because I've been on book tour and promoting, and which has been much more time consuming than I ever thought it would be. And I stopped reading submissions for a couple of months, and so I have them stretching back by the hundreds and hundreds. It's very easy for me to reject stories knowing that I have hundreds out there, just like it's very easy to pass on your date when you realize you have all these other people out there. So I don't tend to build up a big inventory. I feel like in an ideal world, I would be able to pull out 12 essays, get them all set, and take 3 months off. And that has not, I've hardly even had a week off in 10 years, so it just doesn't seem to work that way.
Okay.
Oh, one thing to add to that, though, is I do occasionally share essays that aren't right for Modern Love with the Sunday Review, which is publishing more and more essays these days because they see how popular it is. And twice, just in the past few months, a piece that wasn't right for Modern Love, I sent to them and they published there. So there can be that kind of ripple effect of something being a publishable quality but not right for my section but right for them.
I'm going to cheat and ask two questions. Oh, and I'm going to put the microphone closer. I wonder if you ever hear back from people you've published. One of my favorite essays from Modern Love is from 2010, and I always wonder what happened.
Wait, say it louder.
Oh, I just always wonder if you hear back from people who've had their articles published, either how, A, it's changed their life, or B, how their love has changed, if people ever get back in touch with you. And my second question was about the college Modern Love contest, seeing as how we're in a college town, just what the origins of that is and how that's kind of changed the column.
Okay. And you would start to say one of your favorite essays.
Oh,
was?
One of my favorite essays is from 2010 about the bed bugs.
Okay.
I always wondered.
Did she ever get rid of them?
Yeah, no, not that, I assume. But whatever happened to her in the story, did people ever get back in touch with you?
The most fun part, I do hear from people, and I've published some people more than once. One person I published four times. The writer Anne Hood, who's just the quintessential Modern Love essayist. She just knows how to write an essay and has things to say. I do hear from people. There's been one marriage that resulted from Modern Love with a woman writing about her husband who died at a young age of a brain. I can't remember what it was, but he was in his 40s, I think. And someone had so admired that essay and contacted her, and they were married like a year later. So it does have some of those effects. It has an enormous effect on people's writing career, depending on the kind of story they wrote and how much possibility there is for more to come of that. There have been more than 40 book deals made from people who've had Modern Love essays, which doing the math turns out to be like 1 in 12 published, which to me is just such a high ratio that it's almost ridiculous. I do know that publishers and editors and people in Hollywood and agents all read the column. They just pretty much all do. They see it as a place. Because I, having been a struggling writer who often didn't hear back at all from venues that I would send to, I knew there was a lot of good writing out there, and I wanted to champion people who were starting out. And specifically for this column, where you're really telling an intimate, important, personal story, often writers who have been around for a bit and have published books and written memoirs have told that story. And so it's really the launching pad for an extraordinary number of writing careers, and those people I've kept in touch with and heard from. This tour, the most fun thing about this tour has been getting out and meeting people in person who I published and performing with them in all these venues. In Minneapolis, where I'll go after Detroit tomorrow, I'll be appearing with three SAS and there'll be others in the crowd. And that's been so much fun because all these people have just been a phone call and an email for me. I don't know them beyond that and have never met them. But it's so interesting to keep up with them. One powerful story that I write about in the book, and some of the stories that I write about in the book, I've updated from what the story was in the column, because I got back in touch and said, I'd like to include this. Is that okay with you? And they would say, yeah, but here's what's happened after. And one of those stories was a woman who, talk about this nightmare scenario, a woman who is 19, in college, falls in love with an HIV-positive 42-year-old former drug addict. This didn't go over too well with her mother, you might imagine. And didn't go over that well with her either, but she couldn't. She just loved him, and he was on all the drugs you can be on these days to stay perfectly healthy, and he'd taken care of himself, and he was in great shape. So the essay that ran in Modern Love was about how she overcame her fear that this relationship was just going to be this temporary thing until he died, or how she just gave in and stayed with him anyway. They got married. The mother came to love him, and their relationship went on, had gone on for 8 or so, 10 years before she wrote the piece. Then I got back in touch with her, and it turned out that in the years, 6 or so years that had passed since I ran the piece, she'd been diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer, and she was battling it then. But here was this relationship that started with everything against it and with him headed to an early grave and with him 23 years older than her. And now he's the one who's healthy and taking care of her while she goes through this. So it's, you know, you never really know what you can't know with these things. But it was a very touching addition to the book.
You indicated that most of the pieces that you receive are well written. I'm assuming that you have to do some editing of them. And are there pieces that you receive that have a nub of possibilities that you have to do extensive rewriting on or request that the author do so?
Yes. The amount of editing I do is all over the map. Nothing makes it through exactly as the person submitted it. And in some cases, it can be two-thirds reworked. And exactly as you said, if there's a nub of something or perspective that's so valuable where I feel like I'm not going to get this story from anybody else, so it's going to have to be this person. And these are just unusual situations where there are just not that many people who are going through it, and the story is powerful enough. My editorial process can be anything from just trimming to Well, with each person that I publish, I interview them. We get on the phone and we talk. And I sometimes ask very, very stupid forward questions, almost like a therapist would, just to see what I can pull out. And even if I feel like the story is good to go, there's often really valuable material that comes out of that conversation. And then I just put it in. If I see an opportunity, I just write it in. I'm a very good mimicker of other people's writing styles, and I don't have time to ask them to write it in. I need to get in and out within a matter of days, and I've found that it works, and I have no difficulties with writers. I never wind up in an awkward, uncomfortable situation with a writer doing that, and I got much better at that over the years. But I will write the material in, I send it to them, we go back and forth and back and forth. They can modify it however they like. And a lot of my editing is adjusting to what the times will allow in the paper. And you can't have, you know, a graphic sex scene in the paper. You can't have curse words in the paper. And this is something that's taken me years to learn, what I can get away with. And there's stylistic things that you can't have in the paper. I ran, and this I disagree with, but the having a personal essay column is an odd duck in the newspaper because, you know, in a news story, you get everything important up front, and there's no narrative of things to discover. And in these stories, the most important stuff happens at the end, and you're drawn along by suspense, and you want to find out what happens. You're reading a story, and you want to find out what happens. And I get when I work with the copy desk, they're not used to that form either. And sometimes they'll give away, they'll have a headline or a pull quote that gives away what happens in the story. And they're just, they have no sense that you don't give away what the story's about. The whole point of the headline is to give it away. And the whole point of the pull quote is to give it away. And I'll have to go to them. I'll see it. I'll either see it in advance in a PDF file or whatever. And I'll say, no, please. You know, that's actually a surprise in the piece. Readers read for surprise. So that's the next layer of editing. It goes from, I do 98% of the work. It goes through my top editor, who sometimes has questions or concerns. And then it goes at the last minute past the copy desk and they go through it with their comb and write a headline and do all that. And that's, by that point, it's all in very tight deadline, and then it just goes up online. And the nice thing about online pre-publication is you get yet another proof of it to see. One time a piece went up, and through a copying and pasting error, you wouldn't think like at a place like the New York Times you'd still be relying on copying and pasting text. But through a copying and pasting error, they'd taken off the last two paragraphs of the essay and published it that way. And I don't always double-check with the online version right away. And I'm reading this version. I'm like, this isn't even finished. What are you doing? And they went back and luckily added it in. We have a little break because the Sunday issue doesn't close until Friday night. So we have sort of a whole day to work through any kinks. But the copy desk never makes mistakes. It's unbelievable. They let like one typo a year slide through. It's really amazing how good they are and how important they are. Yeah.
About the drawings, is who does them? Do you have input into that? Who decided the style that they are every week?
Mm-hmm. This is his work as well. The artist's name is Brian Ray. He's the third artist for the column and the longest serving, and he is a total pro. The column started with an illustrator named David Chelsea, who lasted for a few years, and then Christopher Silas Neal lasted for a couple of years. And I believe Brian Ray has been doing it for like 5 years. And he used to be the art director for the Week in Review, what was then called the Week in Review section. He's very experienced, and he lives in L.A., and I also see his work appearing in magazines all over the place. He's really in demand, but what's remarkable to me is that he can do this. He gets the piece first, because he needs the most front work. So I need to give him the essay on Friday for the following Sunday, and over the weekend he comes up with sketches, and then he goes to the art director. And I'm out of the loop on that. I don't see what he's done until it appears on the piece. And I really enjoy that because it's just, it's such, he often has a nice sense of humor. But they're so smart in how they think about how they can capture an essay. There was one essay that was very popular recently about a woman who, a couple who gets divorced, written by a writer for Salon named Mary Elizabeth Williams, and a couple had gotten divorced and then sort of found themselves getting back together again after they'd gotten divorced. And once they were together again, she was diagnosed with this really aggressive, I hate to talk about cancer yet again, but she was diagnosed with this very aggressive form of skin cancer. And she's like, oh, now look what you've gotten yourself into by getting back together with me. You know, that was pretty bad timing on your part. And he did this, and she mentions a ceiling fan in the story. And he has this beautiful blue illustration. I love the hues, colors he uses too. He has this illustration of a ceiling fan with a couple sitting on the end of one of the blades and a bandage around a nearer part of the blade. And it's just like, how do you come up with that? This sort of perfect vulnerability and sense of sort of things being in motion. And so he can really just do beautiful work. I saw him when I was out in L.A. on tour, and I met him in the East, too. They actually did a show in the Times building. They have a gallery, and they did a show of all the Modern Love artwork, which is just spectacular. It was really a lot of fun. Yes?
Picking up on your earlier comments about editing, one of the things that's always impressed me the most about the weekly column is the endings. And I just wonder what percentage of the time that is your work or your way of your contribution, because it's remarkable for even good writers to come up with some of the really poignant final mm-hmm. comments that sometimes bring me to tears.
Oh, good. Thank you for saying that. Endings are crucial, and endings in stories that are submitted, I often say that an ending is where you find out whether the writer was as smart as you thought they were or not. And you're reading along, and it seems like it's heading toward a certain sort of level of revelation, and then you realize it's not heading there, and that's not where you are being led, and the writer doesn't understand anything beyond what you've already been presented. And a lot of stories that I get sucked into until the end fail for that reason. And I can't... I will be able to fashion an ending, I don't know, maybe a third of the time, with what the writer's already given me. But it isn't quite in the right order. That's funny. I mean, the piece that I'm working on right now that would be coming out they'll be coming out next Sunday, was that case where there were elements of the ending there, and I rearranged it and added a line. Sometimes that's where an editor can be most helpful, because you've got the material, you know, you sort of, it's just highlighting it in a way to make it most effective and most sort of resonant. Often endings can be found by chopping off because people have written too far. And often beginnings can be found by chopping off at the beginning because they've started too early. But this stuff is all automatic to me at this point. That's what I've gotten better at more than anything else, is getting into a story and knowing exactly how to edit it. It just feels like a natural impulse. Not to say there aren't challenges in doing it, but it feels so much more of a natural impulse, where I used to just struggle for days over how we were going to get this piece to work.
Is there another question before the book signing? We'll take one more over here, and then we're going to have the book signing. And again, books are for sale by Nicholas Books right out front, but we'll take this one last question.
Hi. You kind of alluded to this, but I would get the impression it would be a very intense experience to get 100-plus personal lives and deep stories every week. How does that bleed into your life? Does that kind of look in really affect you, or is it just kind of systematic at this point?
That's the most commonly asked question I've gotten on my tour, because whenever I'm on the radio or on television, and I always feel like it's implied that I ought to be a better person from having, you know, been immersed in all of this. And I can't really say that that's true. I feel like I'm empathetic about people who are in situations that are unlike my life. I really prefer to read about situations that aren't like my life. And my wife and I often talk about what would have happened if she had been the one to edit the column. And she freely admits that she wants to read about people who are in her situation, and that if she had edited the column, it would have been a lot of women between 40 and 50 writing about the stresses of that circumstance. And every once in a while I'm amused to read about my own life, but I'm so curious about these unusual situations. One of the most powerful stories we have run and that we got the most feedback about in terms of I can't sort of believe that story was one about a woman in North Carolina who got married to this guy. They were married later in life. And after they were married, and he felt the sort of stability of that love, came out and said, you know, I really feel like I'm a woman. I have for a long time. I forgive you if you consider this sort of something that should lead us to break up, but I'd like to give it a try. I feel like we're still the same people, but I feel like if I'm finally at a place in my life where I feel comfortable enough where I want to be able to go through a sex change, and this will go from a straight relationship to a gay one. Anyway, so this essay took place from her driving him to the hospital for the beginning. He'd been on hormones, and this was the beginning of what's called facial feminization surgery, which for her was the change in how she was going to think of him as a she. It was going to happen in one day. She was going to drive him to the hospital as a man and bring him back as a woman, and it was just a striking, striking look into, and she's a good writer. We did a lot of work just to get it right, but that's a situation, like how many people are in that situation? They're more than you'd think, actually, but, and their marriage is, this was about 8 years ago, and their marriage is strong as ever. She was one of the people I was able to see when I went down, I was in Chapel Hill, where she lives, and was able to meet her there. But those sorts of stories, I just think when you read that kind of a story, it opens a window in your heart, you know? And I think it's so easy to dismiss that kind of situation, or any number of others, people who you know, would be judgmental about any kind of situation. Like, I think when you hear a personal story, it can sort of open you to that person's experience. And that's just what it's done for me on a mega level. I don't know if that it's, it, you know, my wife rolls her eyes when I try to say, like, that I've, you know, become better. But so be it. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming out on this nice day.